And after 5 days, Ananias the high priest descended with the elders and with a certain orator named Tertullus, who informed the governor against Paul. And when he was called forth, Tertullus began to accuse him, saying, "Seeing that by thee we enjoy great quietness, and that very worthy deeds are done unto this nation by thy providence, we accept it always and in all places, most noble Felix, with all thankfulness. Notwithstanding that, I be not further tedious unto thee. I pray that thou wouldest hear us of thy clemency a few words. For we have found this man a pestilent fellow, and a mover of sedition among all the Jews throughout the world, and a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes, who also hath gone about to profane the temple, whom we took and would have judged according to our law. But the chief captain Lysias came upon us, and with great violence took him away out of our hands, commanding his accusers to come unto thee, by examining of whom thyself mayest take knowledge of all these things whereof we accuse him." And the Jews also assented, saying that these things were so. When the Jews handed Jesus of Nazareth over to Pilate, they wanted Jesus executed. They did not really have much of a case against Jesus. Obviously, he was falsely accused of what they charged him with, but they did charge him with sedition against Rome, thinking that that would be the most likely way to get his execution accomplished. In Luke chapter 23 and verse 2, this is what they said to Pilate: "We found this fellow perverting the nation and forbidding to give tribute to Caesar, saying that he himself is Christ, a king." And so the Jews' tactic against Paul follow this very same pattern as we see him being accused here before Felix. Now, chapter 23 opened with Paul's hearing before the Sanhedrin council, which ended with Lysias acting to rescue Paul because he was afraid that he would be killed once again. And there were some Jews that responded to this by forming a syndicate and conspiring to kill Paul. And their plot was fairly simple. They would get the council to convene and to call for Paul to be brought to them, and they would ambush him as he was being transferred, and they would kill him before he reached the judgment hall. The plot was, in fact, foiled by Paul's nephew, who learned of it. He shared it with Paul and later shared it with Lysias. And Lysias sent Paul to Caesarea and to the governor Felix, which is where Paul is when our text opens. Felix agreed to hear the case and to wait for his accusers from Jerusalem. So chapter 24 then opens with the arrival of Ananias and some elders from Jerusalem, and they have come to make their case against Paul. And their accusations against Paul focus more on the political side than on the theological side, which is really where the crux of their distaste for Paul is. And they charge him with sedition, which is a serious crime and could have led to a death sentence if found guilty. So we're going to look here at the charge, the accusation that they make against Paul through their hired attorney, Tertullus, here in verses 1 to 9. So beginning in verse number 1. "And after 5 days, Ananias the high priest descended with the elders and with a certain orator named Tertullus, who informed the governor against Paul." So here in verse number 1 of this chapter, Luke sets the scene for the trial that Paul is put to. The 5 days that he mentions would be 5 days after Paul's arrival in Caesarea. We know that Lysias moved Paul out of Jerusalem at night under the cover of darkness, and he had most likely arrived in Caesarea by the next night. And most likely the day following Paul's departure, Lysias would have informed the Jewish leaders of their need to go and to make their charges against Paul known to Felix there in Caesarea. So the journey from Jerusalem to Caesarea was about 60 miles, something over that actually. And it would have taken somewhere around 2 to 4 days, depending on their mode of transportation. And they would certainly need at least a day after their arrival to make all of the necessary arrangements for this trial and to lodge their formal charge against Paul. So what all this means is that if they arrived there 5 days after that Paul arrived, they must have left Jerusalem pretty quickly. They had learned of Paul's transfer, and they received what really amounts as a summons to appear before Felix. And so they must have left pretty quickly within that time to get there 5 days after that Paul himself had arrived. And then we have a number of characters that are brought to us in this verse. First of all is Ananias, the high priest, and some elders from Jerusalem. Ananias, the high priest, and some of the elders that are mentioned here, they would be the recognized Jewish officials, with the high priest himself being really the highest ranking Jewish official that would have been recognized by Rome within the population of Israel. Now, Ananias was the high priest, and he was a Sadducee. Likely the elders that came with him were Sadducees as well. And so we can discern at least their primary motives as they come here to accuse Paul. Being a Sadducee, they had both what we would consider long-term motives and short-term motives. The long-term motives of the Sadducees was that they wanted to maintain power. They were the party within Israel that had the high priests and the chief priests and had the majority control of the Sanhedrin council. They wanted to maintain their power, and also they wanted an independent Jewish state. And this was one of the things that was a difference between Pharisees and Sadducees as to how they were going to achieve that independent Jewish state. So one of the long-term goals is that the Sadducees sought their independence through political alliance and cooperation with Rome. Their idea was not a revolution. It was not an overthrow of Rome, but it was rather that of a cooperation, hoping to be able to achieve that independent status. That was a long-term goal of the Sadducees. So that certainly would be playing a part as they appear before Felix. They're not wanting to put themselves at odds with the Roman Empire. They have a working relationship there that they're wanting to maintain. So they're going to be careful as to how they approach Felix, the governor of the province of Judea. But they also had short-term goals. And the short-term goals was that they wanted Paul dead. They would have been happy if he had been killed by the crowd at the temple that day there in Jerusalem. They would have been happy if Lysias had ordered his execution. They would have been happy if the conspiracy had in fact succeeded in killing Paul. And they would also be happy if Felix would order his execution. You see, as a short-term goal, they wanted Paul dead. And they wanted him dead whether that was within the law or whether it was without the law. They were willing to back the conspiracy to try to kill him. They just wanted Paul dead one way or the other. And trying to find the most efficient means of making that happen was obviously very important in terms of their goals, their motives. And then we have the next character that is mentioned here. Someone they brought with them, a certain orator named Tertullus. Tertullus, an orator. Now the term there means a public speaker. Now when it is used in a legal or in a trial setting, this term means what we would call an attorney. He was a hired attorney to advocate for the prosecution in the case against Paul. As I understand it, according to Roman law, there was no state prosecution, but there were the prosecution had to be hired or brought privately or what have you. So there, he was hired to advocate for the prosecution in this case against Paul. Now, Tertullus is a Roman name, and nothing is known of his background. It is possible that he was a Hellenistic Jew, much like Paul was, and Paul being a Roman name as well. So it's very possible he was a Hellenistic Jew. What we do know of him is really all that we can discern from this particular account. Since he was a hired attorney, that means that he was a professional. This is how he made his living. So obviously when we're thinking about the motivations of Tertullus, a paycheck is an obvious motivation. And it puts him in sympathy with his clients above any concern for the man that is accused, above any concern of whether or not justice is actually served, and above any concern over the fact that he's actually, throughout this process in this last section of Acts, he's actually declared innocent several times and still yet remains imprisoned. If he was a Jew, then perhaps he had some natural sympathy with the Jewish leaders. But that's not entirely clear. It tells us in this verse also that the Ananias and the elders and Tertullus informed the governor against Paul. That they informed the governor likely refers to what we would think of as a deposition. They gave forth their preliminary statements, and it was deemed worthy of going to a trial. Now, the governor that is mentioned is the governor Felix. He's the governor of the province of Judea. My understanding of Felix's background is he was a man that was a slave that had been freed and essentially rose to power through some family connections and some other connections that he had. He occupies the position that was once held by Pontius Pilate as the governor of the province of Judea. Pilate, of course, being the one who oversaw the trial and the crucifixion of Jesus Christ. Now, Felix has the historical reputation as being a self-serving, power-hungry, bloodthirsty, cruel leader and politician. So his motivation is obviously political power and promotion. From the full account, he obviously does not know what to do with Paul. He never declares Paul innocent. This is one case in which Paul is not stated to be innocent by Felix. But he does have talks with Paul later that are talked about in this chapter. But also he hopes to receive a bribe for Paul's freedom. So Felix's political power is in some ways dependent on the Jews' favor. And so he does want to appease them. And last of all, we have in this verse Paul, the accused. The man who is accused, though he is never convicted of any crime, but he remains a prisoner throughout the remainder of the book of Acts. And he's tried before various government officials. So what is Paul's motivation? As we see them all brought together here in this one scene, each one having their own agenda, having their own concerns, and then there is a certain intersection between some of those things. But what is Paul's motivation? Well, Paul's motivation is quite clear from his conduct and his past record we have in the book of Acts, as well as his writings to the churches and his preachings we have record of. Paul's motivation is to make Jesus Christ known and to fulfill the commission that has been given to him. Now, Paul does speak at these trials in his own defense, and he shows intelligence and skill in doing so, but securing his freedom is not his top priority. That is not what Paul is about as he is tried before these officials. We know from the testimony of Jesus, the word that was given to Paul in the vision, that Paul has fulfilled his testimony in Jerusalem, and now he must do the same in Rome. So Paul has a motivation to get to Rome. And if released, no doubt that's where he would head for. But if not, he knows he has another option to get there, an option which he will ultimately exercise. So now we begin to get to the accusation itself. Verse number 2. And when he was called forth, Tertullus began to accuse him, saying, "Seeing that by thee we enjoy great quietness, and that very worthy deeds are done unto this nation by thy providence." So the case was obviously sufficiently meritorious that Paul was called to appear before Felix for trial. And Tertullus here opens with introductory remarks that are conventional for this setting. So what I understand of the Roman process is that this accusation would be given orally in a court, in an assembled court there. The accusation would be given orally. It would be taken down by transcriptionists that would take it down in right hand, in shorthand rather, and then they would write it up in sort of a summary report, and then those would all become official documents of court, and they would be made available to the defense and to the prosecution and to whoever was concerned in what was taking place. And so what we have here most likely is a copying out of this summary report of the charge that Tertullus made against Paul here this day. So again, he opens it in a very customary and a very conventional manner for the procedures of that day. He begins speaking in praise of Felix. Notice he says, "Seeing that by thee," talking about Felix, "we enjoy great quietness, and that very worthy deeds are done unto this nation by thy providence." He's particularly crediting Felix with the peace that the Jews enjoy, and his providence, which is his thoughtful planning in legal matters that have benefited the Jews. Now, there's obvious flattery that is taking place in the words of Tertullus, but I do believe that he's quite a skilled orator, and he is touching on a couple of issues that are going to directly relate to the case against Paul. And that is the matter of legal matters within Jerusalem and in Israel, and as well as that of violence and insurrection and that sort of thing. So, Felix himself was known for violent repercussions against rebels and disturbers of the peace. So it was actually under Felix that rebellion of the Egyptian, whom Claudius Lysias thought that Paul was when he first saw this disturbance, it was actually under Felix that this was put down in a very bloody manner, but that Egyptian rebel escaped. So that was Felix's reputation. And under his reign, really there was quite a lot of unsettling, and conditions within Jerusalem and surrounding areas quite deteriorated until we get to the rebellion that brought Titus down in 70 AD. And we know what happened then with the destruction of the temple and so forth. So in other words, you couldn't really classify the time of Felix's reign as being a time of peace and prosperity within Israel. So is Tertullus here simply just engaging in flattery? Or is he also, it would seem, referring to something that's going to be of interest? In other words, whatever peace was there, Felix had secured by very decisive action against those who were seen as revolutionaries. And that is essentially what Paul is being charged with being. So this is what Tertullus will charge him with. Let's move on in his charge. Verse 3. "We accept it always and in all places, most noble Felix, with all thankfulness." The use of "we" here by Tertullus could indicate that he was a Jew, or it may just reflect the fact that he's arguing on behalf of his clients. He speaks of the Jewish favor toward Felix here. No doubt, again, this is an exaggeration, but it does also contribute to the case that he's making against Paul. So in essence, Tertullus is planting the seeds in the mind of Felix that the Jews are standing with you. They're standing with you and standing with the Roman Empire. And this Paul is trying to incite the Jews to rebellion, or to at least disturbance of the peace that we enjoy throughout the empire. Verse 4. Notwithstanding that I be not further tedious unto thee, I pray thee that thou wouldest hearest of thy clemency a few words. So this statement actually concludes the introductory remarks, the part of that accusation that Tertullus is making. Again, it's customary in this setting. You'll notice here that he makes a statement of self-imposed brevity. Self-imposed brevity, that quality that is, as I have read, is often praised and seldom practiced. I'm going to be short. I'm going to give you just a few words. Of course, I learned as just a little boy with my feet dangling off the edge of a pew that when a preacher says that, it means absolutely nothing. Don't believe it. I'm just going to keep you for a little while. Yeah, don't believe it. So he makes a statement of brevity. I don't want to be tedious, and I don't want to wear you out. I just want to give you a few words, is what he's saying. But a self-imposed brevity is also a signal that there's much more that could be said. Now, that could be a bluff, but it is a signal that, in other words, it's a rhetorical device that can be used to make you think that I'm just going to give you just a little smidgen of what I've got, and I've got a whole lot more where that came from. So this is obviously what he's communicating in favor of the prosecution. But then we get to the actual accusation, beginning in verse 5. "For we have found this man a pestilent fellow, and a mover of sedition among all the Jews throughout the world, and a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes." So here Tertullus begins to state the facts of the case against Paul. He calls Paul a pestilent fellow, which amounts to calling him a plague. This man is a plague on society. This man is a communicable infectious disease, is what he calls Paul. Now, in legal terms, it meant that this man is a menace. He is a public menace. He's a threat to the public peace and well-being. Notice that he charges him that he's a mover of sedition among all the Jews throughout the world. The word that's used there for sedition is a word that indicates that he's causing riots. He's inciting riots among the Jews throughout the world. This is a political charge, one that is trying to incite a rebellion against Rome and against the government. At least it's a charge against one that is trying to cause dissension and to destroy the peace of the cities and provinces. And we know that those Roman officials throughout the empire, one of their chief concerns was to maintain the peace so that the Roman army did not come in and get involved. He also charges Paul here, he says, with being a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. He charges Paul with being a chief leader of this sect of the Nazarenes. Now, historically, there's no sect of the Nazarenes. This is what he has chosen to label Paul and those that he wins, essentially, to his preaching. Nazarenes is obviously an association with Jesus of Nazareth. And the use of sect here, the word that is used here that's translated sect, which is also a word sometimes we translate as heresy. It's a word that means a party or a faction. But this use of sect gives two particular signals to Felix. First of all, by calling them a sect, he is signaling that Paul and those of his persuasion are distinct from Judaism. Now, you will recall that Lysias came to the conclusion that the arguments against Paul was some sort of an internal debate within Judaism. This is a question of the manners and customs of their law. That's what Lysias sent in his letter to Felix. But here, Tertullus is signaling to Felix that this is in fact not an internal debate within Judaism. This is a sect. This is something different, separate, distinct from Judaism. And the second signal that he's giving by referring to it as a sect is that this is a party or a faction. This is a group that is not officially recognized by Rome like Judaism is. So in other words, this is an illegal movement against Rome, separate from Judaism, distinct from Judaism. Now in verse number 6, Tertullus continues, "Who also hath gone about to profane the temple, whom we took and would have judged according to our law." So Tertullus now moves to the proofs of his case. So he's stated the facts of the case. Now he's giving the proofs. He states that Paul was trying to defile the temple in Jerusalem. So notice how Tertullus has brought Paul's activities from a desire to incite Jews throughout the world to a specific desire to try to defile the temple in Jerusalem. Now, the temple was actually protected by Roman law, and intentionally defiling it was a serious crime, and called for the death penalty if someone was convicted of it. Tertullus says that Paul was moving with intent to defile the temple, and he was stopped by the Jews apprehending him. Tertullus is here careful to provide not only supports for the accusations that have been made against Paul by these proofs, but he's also at the same time providing an apologetic for the actions of the Jews in Jerusalem. He mentions the intervention of Lysias in verse number 7. But the chief captain Lysias came upon us, and with great violence took him away out of our hands. So as Tertullus describes the intervention of Lysias, you realize that it doesn't seem that he's making a complaint against Lysias as much as he's providing here an explanation for the disturbance among the crowd at the temple that day. So what is interesting to note is that this is now the third account of those events that we have. We have the first account that is given by Luke the historian. He gives us the historical account as it unfolded at the temple that day. The second account we have is in the letter that Lysias sent to Felix as he describes the events there and his actions in regard to it. Now we have an account on behalf of the Jews of what happened that day. And you notice how in the account of Lysias, he framed things in a certain way to look more favorable upon him and his actions. And now the account given by Tertullus frames it in a certain way that makes it look more favorable upon the Jews. It comes from their perspective of events. Yes, he was trying to defile the temple, which they had the authority to seize him and even to put him to death in such cases, if in fact that's what he was doing. Yeah, he was trying to defile the temple, and we apprehended him and would judge him according to our law, which was their legal right and prerogative to do. But Lysias intervened. He comes in with violence and force. In other words, he's giving here an explanation of a tumult, of a crowd, an uproar that happened at the temple that day. He's accounting for it. And then in verse number 8, commanding his accusers to come unto thee by examining of whom thyself mayest take knowledge of all these things whereof we accuse him. So he's further explaining now their appearance before Felix, why they are there. Lysias had given them command. So verse 8 is where Tertullus concludes his speech, his giving of his accusations against Paul. And you'll notice that at the end, he recommends the examination of Paul to confirm the accusations that have been made. So, as you look through this, Tertullus was obviously skilled at what he was doing. And he planted certain seeds, and he signaled with various key phrases, and he gave an explanation, and one that would make the Jews appear to be not at fault, and in fact on the side of Felix. Really, though, when we look at it, the case against Paul was very weak. He offered little in the way of any sort of hard evidence of that Paul was guilty of the things he was being charged with. In other words, he didn't have any real objective evidence. He didn't have any real corroborating witnesses. The actual charges that he makes against Paul are more subjective. Things like charging Paul with intent to defile the temple. Well, that's a charge that's hard to defend against. He was trying to defile the temple. Well, it's pretty hard to say what someone was trying to do or planning to do, especially without some sort of hard evidence to substantiate that. But when you think about it, as Tertullus has moved throughout this accusation, he has woven together certain subjective elements and certain objective charges given certain verifiable facts. In other words, it can be verified that Paul was there at the temple that day. It can be verified that there was an uproar that day, that Paul was involved in that. It can be verified that Tertullus came in and seized Paul. I mean, all of those are things that are verifiable facts through all of the various channels. But of course, verifying some things does not verify everything. I mean, let's say that there was a murder that took place on a crowded platform at a train station. And if there was a survey taken of all of those who had bought tickets, then it could be verified that they were present at the time that that murder took place. But that doesn't mean that they were guilty of the murder or that they had anything to do with it at all. In fact, it might have been someone who didn't have a ticket to ride the train that day, but had come there with an express purpose because they knew that the intended passenger would be there at that time and to kill them. So what I'm saying is, Tertullus is very, very skilled, very clever in what he's doing. He's making charges that really are hard to substantiate, but he's propping those weak charges up with certain facts that can be verified, that Paul was in this place, that certain things have happened, Lysias did come in, and that seems to give his case more weight. There's obviously a good reason why they hired him to do what he's doing. He's probably making about the best case that could be made. Verse 9, "And the Jews also assented, saying that these things were so." The Jews here refers obviously to Ananias, the high priest, and the elders with him. And they are consenting, or they are agreeing to the charges as Tertullus laid them out, as well as the various facts he gave. Now, whether they gave any sort of individual testimony or what, we don't know. It's not recorded for us. But in some way, they signaled their agreement officially with all the things that Tertullus had said. So as we think about this particular instance and where Paul is with all of these conflicting agendas, and Paul seeming to be on the bad end of this deal from every which way around, we think back again to the fact of how that Jesus was treated. Of course, Jesus, being sinless, was never guilty of any sort of crime against anyone, God or man. So any sort of punishment that he would receive would obviously be unfair and unjust. We see in the case of Jesus that there were various forces that all had their own agendas and all had their own motivations, but they all lined up together against him and put him to death for various reasons. They all had their different reasons. He taught his disciples in words that are true for all of his followers. John chapter 15, verses 18 to 20. Jesus said, "If the world hate you, you know that it hated me before it hated you. If you were of the world would love his own. But because you're not of the world, but I've chosen you out of the world, therefore the world hateth you. Remember the word that I said unto you, the servant is not greater than his Lord. If they have persecuted me, they will also persecute you. If they have kept my saying, they will keep yours also." We are seeing this lived out in the life of Paul. Various forces are coming together, again, having their own agendas. Just as we considered Lysias in the past few scenes where we saw him, he wasn't acting out of any love or concern for Paul. I mean, at first he was getting on the chance to apprehend this fugitive from justice, thinking that he was that Egyptian rebel. And then later he was more concerned about handling Paul because he was a freeborn Roman citizen. He had no concern for truth. He wasn't concerned over whether there really was a resurrection of Jesus Christ, or whether there really will be a resurrection of the dead, or what the Bible and the prophets had to say about these things. He's not concerned about any of that. So there's all of these various forces that all have their own agendas, and yet they come together and they intersect at this one point in this unjust trial of Paul. Yeah, the powers of the world really don't care about truth. They're not really concerned about what God's word has to say and who in fact is standing on the right side of God's word. They're just not really concerned about that. Felix was not consulting the Old Testament to see whether or not the things that Paul was saying was right and whether or not Paul should be punished. That was not the standard that he was going to appeal to. So, ultimately we learn, just as Jesus told this to his disciples, we've seen it lived out in their lives, we're seeing this lived out in the life of Paul, and it's been lived out in the life of his followers throughout this age. In the service of Jesus Christ and his gospel, to put it plainly, don't expect a fair fight. Jesus didn't have a fair fight. Nor did Paul, and nor will we.